We left off last time in Mark 9, verse 30, where Jesus had just driven a demon out of a boy after the disciples had failed. He had been on top of the mountain, the transfiguration. The other nine disciples who weren't there had failed to drive this demon out. They're way up north of Israel at this time, the farthest Jesus ever went from Jerusalem. And now it's time for him to begin his journey back down to Jerusalem for his appointment with the cross. So it starts here. In today's passage, we find him sneaking around in Galilee. Verse 30, they left that place and passed through Galilee. Jesus did not want anyone to know where they were because he was teaching his disciples. So he's sneaking through there, trying to go unnoticed. He wants to teach them. This is the last mention of Galilee until after the resurrection. Jesus is done with Galilee. They had their chance. They blew it. So from now until he gets to Jerusalem, the public ministry is over. This is going to be a traveling classroom where the disciples get their final semester of training before he dies. And you'll never guess what the topic is. Verse 31, he said to them, "The Son of Man is going to be delivered into the hands of men. They will kill him, and after 3 days he will rise." Here we go again with that. Jesus keeps bringing it up. And each time he does, he adds something new. What's new here is the part about being delivered into the hands of men in verse 31. He hasn't mentioned that before. Now, of all the punishments God gives, being delivered over to the hands of men is the worst. When God lets human beings mete out your punishment. Remember when David had displeased God with the census, and God told him, "All right, David, pick your punishment. 3 years of famine, 3 months of fleeing from your enemies, or 3 days of plague. Your choice." And David's answer was anything but number two. In 2 Samuel 24:14, David said, "Let us fall into the hands of the Lord, for his mercy is great, but do not let me fall into the hands of men." Being turned over to the mercy of human beings is a horrible fate. Because human beings, once they feel justified in hurting you, there's no restraints. It turns into a mob mentality, conscience disappears, and it's a feeding frenzy. No mercy at all. And it's more painful than other kinds of suffering because of the hatred behind it. People hurting you on purpose because they hate you. You'll notice when you read the biblical accounts of the crucifixion, they talk about just as much about the spitting and the mocking as they do about the physical torture. That hatred that was involved in the crucifixion made the suffering much worse. And so Jesus is telling them, that's going to happen. I'm going to be given over to the hands of men. And I can tell you, of all the hardships I've faced in my life, nothing has been as painful as when God has given me over to the hands of my enemies. There are layers of anguish that come from that are hard to even put into words. And of course, in Jesus' case, the anguish was infinitely worse because of how much Jesus loved those people who were mocking him. And Jesus wants his disciples to know what's coming. Jesus doesn't get the three options David got. He's not going to get that. He just gets the one that David said, definitely not that one. That's the one Jesus gets. Jesus is going to be thrown into a pack of vicious, hateful men insane with jealousy, and there will be no restraints. The 12 legions of angels protecting Jesus will be told to stand down. When Jesus cries out to the Father to let this cup pass, the answer is going to be no. Everyone will forsake him, and God will allow Jesus' enemies to do their worst. This is a terrifying prophecy. The Son of Man is going to be delivered into the hands of men. And if you think back to the first time Jesus spoke of his upcoming suffering, back in chapter 8, you'll remember that if Christ must suffer, so must those who follow him. That's always the implied application and implication whenever Jesus talks about this. So every time he talks about his rejection and suffering and death, that included in that is our rejection and suffering and death. So Jesus explains all that, and what's their response? Verse 32. But they did not understand what he meant. So the disciples are 0 for 3 now in their ability to get this. The more clearly Jesus says it, the more confused they get. I am red-green colorblind, which means I can see most colors, but I have trouble making out those two shades, red and green. The disciples were suffering blind. Everything else that Jesus said they could make out just fine, they could see it just fine, but they went blind and deaf whenever Jesus started talking about suffering. and it was a willful blindness and deafness. If they wanted to understand, all they had to do was ask, but they don't. Verse 32, they did not understand what he meant and were afraid to ask him about it. We saw the same thing in the Transfiguration. Remember, they had two questions after as they were coming down the mountain. What about Elijah? And what does rising from the dead mean? What do you mean by that, rising from the dead? They asked the Elijah question, no problem, but not the question about Jesus rising, dying and rising. They're afraid to ask that one. And that catches our attention at this point in Mark, because it's different from what we've seen previously in the book. Up until now, the main difference between the crowds and the disciples has been whenever Jesus said something hard, the crowds went away confused. They just went away scratching their heads and they're content to be confused. But the disciples followed him into the house and asked him, what does that mean? What does that mean? That's what we've seen up to now. But on this topic, they won't do it because they're afraid of the answer. They didn't fully understand what Jesus meant, but they understood enough to know that they didn't want to understand anymore. And so they were afraid. Verse 32, afraid to ask him. Anytime God starts talking to us about suffering, our ears tend to clog up and we get real hard of hearing because we're scared to death of suffering. We don't want to hear it. And that part's easy enough to understand. No one wants to suffer. But there's more to it, this than that. Here, there's a deeper reason why the disciples go so tone deaf to Jesus whenever he starts talking about this topic. And Mark's going to show us why. He's not going to tell us why, because Mark doesn't do it. Mark writes with a paintbrush instead of a pen, remember? He likes to show rather than tell. And so that's what he's going to do. Three times Jesus teaches the 12 about his suffering, and all three times, guess what Mark places in the very next paragraph? I'll show you here. For the first time, it was in chapter 8. He talked about his suffering, and immediately one of them rebuked Jesus. Now he brings it up again in chapter 9. He mentioned it on the Mount Transfiguration to the three, but the second time to the 12 in chapter 9, he mentions it here. And what's the very next thing that is recorded? They get into an argument about who's greatest. Then in chapter 10, in the next chapter, he's going to bring it up another time, and how are they going to respond there? Mark 10:33, the Son of Man will be delivered over to the chief priests and the teachers of the law. They will condemn him to death and will hand him over to the Gentiles, who will mock him, spit on him, flog him, and kill him. 3 days later, he will rise. Then James and John came to him. Teacher, verse 37, let one of us sit on your right and the other at your left in glory. It's the same thing every time. Jesus says, I'm going to suffer. And they say, yeah, whatever. By the way, aren't we great? They're consumed. Now, this isn't to suggest that this was their immediate response each time. Time may have elapsed between, in fact, it did in this case, elapsed between Jesus talking about his suffering and their focus on their own greatness. But the point Mark is making by his arrangement of the material is very clear. With his paintbrush, he's showing us that why they were unable to understand whenever Jesus talked about this. There was a disease in their hearts, causing this selective blindness and deafness. And Mark paints us a picture or shows us an x-ray of that disease by the way he arranges the material. And even if you're not trained in reading x-rays, the disease isn't hard to spot. What is it? Self-exaltation, right? The first time Peter exalted himself above Jesus and rebuked him. The second time, they all try to exalt themselves above one another, arguing about who's the greatest. The third time, the sons of thunder are jockeying for the top two spots in the kingdom. Self-exaltation, self-exaltation, self-exaltation. And what had Jesus taught them was the proper response to his instruction about his upcoming suffering. The first time he brought it up, what did he say? What's the proper response? Self-denial. Remember, Mark 8:31. He then began to teach them that the Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders, the chief priests, and the teachers of the law, and that he must be killed and after 3 days rise again. Then Peter and Jesus rebuke each other. Then this, if anyone would follow me, he must deny himself. The teaching about Jesus' suffering calls for self-denial. That's the proper response. One reason Jesus died was to help us stop living for ourselves. 2 Corinthians 5:15. Christ died for all, that those who live should no longer live for themselves, but for him who died for them and who was raised again. Not living for yourself is another way of saying deny yourself. So you can see how if your life is oriented in the direction of self-exaltation, you'll go deaf and blind every time Jesus tries to teach you something that implies self-denial, right? Because self-denial and self-exaltation are like oil and water. If I'm climbing the ladder of earthly greatness, the moment you talk to me about suffering and lowliness and rejection, my brain is going to go to a blue screen, right? Internal server error. System shutdown. Does not compute. When Mark keeps on showing us the disciples' confusion over and over on this point, the purpose isn't for us to say, oh, wow, Jesus sure did pick a bunch of dumbcoughs as his disciples. The point is to see how different Jesus' attitude is from the natural human attitude. The disciples' attitude is not unusually bad. It was the normal human way of thinking that we all have. We all turn into dumb coughs when God tries to tell us that the path that he has for us right now is a path of lowliness and humility, don't we? I mean, we just don't hear. We cry out, God, show me your will. And God says, okay, my will is for you to go and do that. What? I don't get it. I can't make up what you're saying. God, why are you being so silent? I'm praying for guidance. Why don't you show me what I should do? And God says, I told you, I want you to do this hard thing. What? You're breaking up. God, hello? God, why won't you speak to me? We can't hear because we don't want to hear. Whenever God calls us to do something that hinders our quest for earthly greatness, that requires humbling yourself, forgiving someone who really hurt you, going to a person to reconcile a broken relationship, giving up comfort or money or security, or to go do something that has no guarantees, anything that's going to put you in a position of lowliness, we just naturally get really confused. Why? Because it's complicated? No. It's because if you eliminate the right answer to a question, trying to figure out another answer is always going to be really confusing, no matter how easy the question is, right? Because if you're working on 2+2, but you rule out 4 as a possibility, then suddenly it becomes an incredibly complicated problem that leaves you stumped. When you're seeking human greatness, suffering and humiliation are just eliminated as possibilities. And then we have a hard time figuring out what direction God is pointing us. Jesus is going to give us a remedy to this in the next passage. He's going to show us how to fix this disease in our hearts that makes us blind and deaf. But for now, let's just apply Mark's x-ray machine to our own hearts. We've seen the disciples. Let's look at our own. Instead of reading this and thinking, oh, those guys are just such morons, a better thing would be for us to ask, is there anything the Lord wants to teach me right now that he can't teach me because of some attitude in my heart that's blocking it? We would do well to take a little time and search our hearts. Ask God to search your heart and reveal any attitude that's causing deafness whenever God wants to teach you certain lessons, especially ones that involve lowliness. One other thought I'd like to leave you with. Regarding this issue of being given over to the hands of men, it's good for us to remember whenever that happens, it's God's doing. He's the one who gives you over. There are plenty of people who would like to take control of your fate to one degree or another, right? You might have enemies who are actively trying to destroy your life, or may just be people around you who want to use you or manipulate you in some way for their agenda. Or maybe you're just in the way of their agenda and all they just want to run over you or whatever. Whenever you encounter someone like that, one of two things is going to happen. Either God will give you over to their power and they will win, or he won't give you over and you'll be safe. Now, why would God give you over? Well, in some cases, it's chastisement for sin, like it would have been for David in 2 Samuel 24 if he would have chosen door number 2. But in other cases, it's the result of you obeying God. It's not about sin, it's about obedience, like it was for David before he became king, when he was being chased by his enemies all over the place. It might be the purpose simply of testing your faith, or maybe some other purpose that you don't even know. The important thing is to realize that whatever the reason, it's from God. It's from God. When we are given over to the hands of men, when people have control over your life to hurt you, that's usually the hardest time to remember the sovereignty of God, isn't it? We can remember the sovereignty of God if a tornado hits our house or something. But when it's people, when it's our enemies, we get so focused on what people are doing to hurt us, sinful people, that we lose sight of the fact of this, that the whole situation is from the hand of God, just like every other trial in your life is. But if we can remember that, it makes it so much easier to take, because you know for sure it's for a good purpose, right? Everything God does is good for his children. When other people are in control of your life in some area, and they're making decisions that are to your detriment, it's natural to just get worked up, think your life is ruined, whatever. But we need to remember that when God gives you over to the hands of men, if you're his child, he is doing that for your ultimate good. And you can trust him in that just as much as in anything else. And how do we know that for sure? How do we know that it's not just pure punishment and retribution for our sins? Because Jesus was turned over to the hands of men out of punishment and retribution for our sins. That's what Jesus is talking about here.